Radio News, I'm Richard Stewart. Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum is defending his use of spending earmarks in Congress, saying some were necessary for defense or health programs. In addition, in a speech at an Oklahoma City hotel, Santorum says environmental concerns surrounding fracking are unfounded.
We have to have all sorts of government regulations now because of the threats of hydro. It's the new boogeyman.
It could be the beginning of the end for No Child Left Behind. President Obama has freed 10 states from some of the landmark law's toughest requirements. Those states could, for example, now judge students with methods other than test scores. They also will be able to factor in subjects beyond reading and math. The average rate on the 30-year fixed mortgage stayed at a record low this week. Freddie Mac says the rate on the 30-year loan was unchanged at 3.87%. You're listening to IRN USA Radio News.
Views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the hosts and guests and not necessarily those of the staff or management of KLAV.
Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Mike Shackelford.
All right. Our guest tonight will be Josh Axelrad. He's author of the book, Repeat Until Rich. We'll be talking to Josh in about 15 minutes or so. Since our last show, there was a football game. Super Bowl. Michael encouraged us to bet the no safety, saying the odds were in our favor for that bet. So, Mike, how did it go?
It did not go well, obviously. As I believe you asked me when I was a guest on the show about Super Bowl props, I mentioned the no safety as one that is good every single year, and I stand by that. The probability of a safety is about 5.8%, making it fair laying about 16-1. And this particular Super Bowl, I was having a hard time finding a decent bet. Up until a certain point, I could only find laying 13-1, which is not very good. I only bet a little bit. But Friday night before the game, went over to the Suncoast on a last run of prop hunting, and they had it laying 9-1. So I bet $9,000 on it. And Sunday morning, I went back and bet another $4,500. The line was the same. I think some square out there at one of the Boyd Gaming properties was betting that there would be a safety, and I was taking it the other way. And we all know what happened. The very first score was a safety, which not only ruined that bet, but it ruined my bet on the first score to be a touchdown. That was a horrible way to start the game, and there was just no crawling out of the hole after that.
Well, way. I followed a lot of Mike's betting suggestions, and the good part of it is after that, we broke even. So anyway, I took a bath this year on it, and I will be following his advice again next year. I believe we had the edge when we were betting, and sometimes it goes against you.
Yep. As I always say, it's not whether you win or lose. It's whether or not you had a good bet. And betting the no safety, I absolutely believe was a good bet. So I'm not going to apologize for recommending that before. And, you know, if it's of any comfort to anyone who followed my advice and bet that, I went right down the ship with you.
Oh, good. So we all died together. That makes me feel great. All right.
If that makes you feel better.
All right, good. Now, last week, you hummed a song that was driving you crazy because you couldn't quite identify it. You asked our listeners to help with identification. And we said the prize for the first correct answer, that, well, there were two prizes mentioned. The first I suggested was that whoever gave the right answer would get $1 million from you. And the second suggestion was an autographed copy of your book, Gambling 102. So, first, did we have a winner, and who was it?
Yes, I think those two prizes are worth about the same. And lots of people wrote to me about that, both to the show and to my other various email addresses. And let me tell you the answer. The answer was called the Manamana Song. And it is most famous from The Muppet Show. And I think the reason it got stuck in my head is I took my five-year-old to see The Muppets movie, and they played that at the end, I now realize, when they were playing the credits. And, all the stars did cameos singing the song. But it's been played on The Muppet Show, Sesame Street, The Benny Hill Show, and various other shows. It's just a common tune. And according to Wikipedia, it was originally part of an Italian movie about the sex scene in Sweden from way back in the 70s. And I don't think anyone really remembered the movie, but this song was a big hit. And about the winner, I think that there should be two winners. Is after the show, John, who does the introduction to the show, said, wasn't that on the Benny Hill Show? And I incorrectly corrected him and said, no, you must be thinking of Yakety Sax, which is what they play at the beginning and the end of the Benny Hill Show. But they also played Manamana on some of the skits. So he is going to get a copy of my book. But the first person to write in a correct answer was from New Jersey. He's somebody who I already know and already has a copy of my book, so I'm going to be treating him to a free dinner the next time he is in Vegas.
All right. Since we're both friends of Max Rubin, I hope this is going to be a comped dinner.
It probably will be.
Okay, good.
I always have points somewhere.
All right. Now, another thing we mentioned last week was the blackjack bingo card at the Palms. I mentioned that some of the numbers were very easy to get, relatively easy, between every 160 or 170 hands, and other ones were almost impossible. So you analyzed it, Mike. What did you find out?
Okay. I'd like to say that the winner, the person who wrote in with the right answer to the question was Mike Hobson. So congratulations, Mike Hobson.
Congratulations.
Okay. So I analyzed this, and so the Palms has this card with eight different events on it, and as they occur to you in blackjack, as long as you have at least a $15 bet, they stamp the card, and if you cover one of four different patterns, you win $50 to $150 in promotional chips, which are full-valued promotional chips, meaning you keep it till you lose it. So one of the events is a suited 777 in the upper right-hand corner. And three of the four events require getting a suited 777. And getting a suited 777 is pretty hard.
How hard is it?
The probability of a suited 777 with six decks is about 1 in 63,000. So I think that kind of ruins the value of the three patterns that require that. I think most of the value in this card is on the bottom row win, where you don't need the suited 777. And I calculate that you can expect to get everything on the bottom row about once every 2,500 hands, which is a lot of play. That pays.
So that's 50 hands an hour. So 2,500 would be 50 hours? Is that right?
Let's see. Yes, it would be. I think that the speed of is a little bit more than 50 hands an hour in blackjack. But,
okay, only 42 hours.
So.
And how much do you get when you do this?
You get $75.
So $75 in 42 hours. So this is about 60 cents an hour.
I didn't calculate it on that basis, but normally the house edge on the Palms rules is 0.48%. If you factor in the value of this promotion, it drops it to 0.28%. So it cuts down the house advantage by about 40%, assuming that you can devote enough time to getting to playing that many hands.
Now, if you were dealt a pair of red sevens versus a dealer six.
Mm-hmm.
Now, normal strategy, your first play would be to split them.
Yes.
And your second play would be to stand. And your third play, by far the worst, would be to take another card.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you had this bingo card out there, and especially if you had both the unsuited 777 and the suited 777, is the card valuable enough that it now becomes a smart play to take the other seven?
Absolutely. And it could actually get pretty mathematically complicated because I was reading the rules, and it said that a player could only have one active card at a time. So let's say the player has already has crossed off any 777 on his card, and he gets another one. He can't ask for just another card for a new stamp, no. You know, he has to surrender an old card if he wants a new one. So what if the player had two suited sevens, and you know, that would significantly increase his incentive to deviate from basic strategy. But I think that with any two sevens on a $15 bet, you should absolutely hit it as opposed to splitting.
If you had that square open on your card.
Yes.
All right. So we have on the line, we have our guest. And our guest is named Josh Axelrad. Josh is, he played blackjack professionally for 5 years very well. And he played poker very badly for 1 year. He graduated from Columbia College. He tried working in investment banking for a while. His blackjack successes and his poker failures are recounted in his memoir, Repeat Until Rich. Josh Axelrad, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks, Bob. Michael, thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
Sorry, go ahead. I could start blathering any second, but I'll wait for you to take the lead.
All right. First of all, I want to congratulate you for the kick-ass title of the book, Repeat Until Rich. That could easily have been the title of this radio show if I had thought of it first. So it sounds like what advantage gambling is all about. You just find what your edge is, and you keep doing it forever and ever and ever until you think you're rich, which, of course, never happens because however rich you are, double that amount is better. So congratulations on the title.
Well, thank you, although I am mired in the sort of existential dilemma that you just indicated because it never seems like you got anything when you won, to be honest. I know that's contrary to the spirit of it, but it's true that the kind of wealth that one dreams of in the gambling world is like it's very far removed from I don't know. I'm still struggling with the question of what wealth would actually constitute. I certainly never had it or met anybody who had it. So if you have any answers to that, I'm listening.
You never met any wealthy person?
I met people who had
lot of money,
wealth in some sense or other. Yeah, exactly.
But not healthy or not in a metaphysical Zen master way. Okay.
Not in every possible way, I guess is what I mean.
Well, speaking of making money, playing blackjack and counting cards and keeping it, the last one of the last chapters in your book is titled "How to Count Cards If You Must," and given the success and all the money that your team made. It seems contradictory to scare away readers of counting cards with a chapter titled that way. Can you tell us basically the pros and cons of counting cards as you see it?
Well, to me, honestly, it seemed compulsory to scare away readers with a chapter with that kind of title. I felt a sort of obligation to put out a clear warning. I didn't want it to be a ringing endorsement and a glamorization and the sort of stuff that people, I didn't want to incubate the kind of fantasies that people tend to get when they read, you know, the Ben Mezrich trash, or they go to Hollywood movies and see glamorized interpretations of card counting that have absolutely no basis in reality. The truth is, most people who buy Beat the Dealer, most people who buy Bringing Down the House or buy Ken Houston's books or Repeat Until Rich, my book, don't have any prayer of ever making, in fact, they're doing themselves harm by learning about card counting and blackjack, because for most people, what all these gambling systems, including the totally legitimate ones, like those that you guys discuss with great authority here, for most people, what those amount to is a pretext. And that would, to the extent that you put forth that pretext without very clear warnings and, you know, disclosures, to the extent that you do that, you're doing marketing on behalf of the casinos. And that's something that you'll never catch me doing. So I really wanted to make it very clear that this is an activity that is not for most people. And if you think it's for you, it's not. If you know it's for you, then you'll have to, you know, do your reckoning. Then maybe, exactly.
So your team in the book, you call Mossad, which is the same name as the Israeli spy group, I guess. Now, we've had some MIT members on this show and written about on a couple of, I guess, what you call Ben Mezrich trash books. How were the Mossad, how were your team different than the MIT teams? What did you do the same and what did you do different?
Well, I can answer that question with some personal authority, because the team that I originally trained with and learned about blackjack with was MIT. I was trained by MIT and an MIT player in the late 90s. And as you know, at that time, the MIT team had existed for quite some time. It had gone through all sorts of permutations. There had been schisms within the team. The MIT team really wasn't a unitary entity so much as a tradition of blackjack practices that had, you know, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology as a kind of center or headquarters. But it was a number of different groups. And the organization that I learned about counting cards with was probably a blackjack team in decline. It wasn't very active. They weren't really focused on going into casinos and getting money out. They were focused on things like training, practicing, which obviously is essential, writing computer sims, talking about it. And occasionally there would be, you know, somebody would get the gumption together and a trip would be organized and it would be brief. And the group that I call Mossad in the book, the group I played with, was very different from that. They were entirely oriented towards getting money out of casinos. They were technically extremely proficient, but they behaved much more like gamblers than anyone I had seen on MIT ever did. They really, really wanted to win. They wanted to win now. They wanted to win tonight. They were completely indifferent to the long-term heat consequences of their activity. The idea was to go in, blast away, and take money out of those casinos and worry about tomorrow.
Uh-huh. Now, you use some disguises along the way, or some acts. One of the two most successful acts that you talk about, one was you were a lobotomized idiot who drools and grunts, and that worked pretty well. And another one was being a very effeminate homosexual, and that seemed to work pretty well for you. Tell us about these things.
Right. Well, the idea, what both of those acts have in common is the following, is that you want the pit to be thinking about something other than the fact that you're moving your bet with the count or coming in mid-shoe when you're signaled to by somebody who's, like, been frozen at that table all night never ordering a cocktail. If they look and see what you're actually doing, they're going to blow you out very quickly, because card counting isn't complicated. It really is the oldest trick, at least in the blackjack books. And, you know, if they think about it, they'll throw you up. So the point of both of those acts, for example, the homosexual act, the point of acting like a flamboyant, effeminate character was nothing, you know, insulting towards homosexuals at all. It was more insulting what I understood the mentality of the pit to be, which is essentially, you know, who is stuck standing on his feet in the pit all day. These are, like, you know, former frat brothers or, like, failed frat brothers, you know, people with something of a fraternity house mentality, who kind of sit there inhaling smoke all day in this miserable occupation. And one thing that can really confuse them is encountering something that's outside of their sort of social comfort group. And so showing them this kind of flamboyant, extroverted, bizarre, apparently gay character was repeatedly so confounding to the pit that they devoted a lot of time to trying to satisfy what I represented as my bizarre, eccentric needs, the types of comps I wanted, the types of clubs I was trying to find that they didn't know how to direct me to, that I had, you know, shift managers running around looking for gay employees to ask them questions to help resolve my needs rather than observing the play go down when, you know, it should have taken them about 40 seconds with their eyes open to understand what was happening in their pit.
What drink did you order doing this act when you were at the tables, if any? Because I've heard that it's a red flag that a man is a homosexual if he orders a cosmopolitan. Is that true?
I don't know.
Okay.
I rarely ordered drinks of any kind. Okay. Although occasionally there's, you know, you order a gin and tonic between Collins, perhaps, go into the bathroom, gargle with it, spit it out, dump it out, replace it with tap water, go back into the pit, and then let somebody in a position of authority watch you guzzle a gin and tonic and then have them, you know, smell your breath, which will be riddled with the gin you are gargling with. That can be effective regardless of what, you know, sexual persuasion you're trying to represent. But with me, it was more like, a, you know, sashaying the hips and being, it was really like out of a, you know, it was like Jack Tripper. I mean, it was bad. It wouldn't have looked credible to somebody who actually had any sense for these things, but it worked often enough in casinos.
That's a good suggestion. Let me ask you another question. You mentioned overbetting your bankroll, and I was an investor for 2 years on another blackjack team, and this team managed to lose money. And to this day, none of the investors knows why. And it could be overbetting the bankroll. It could be bad management. But I've always suspected that maybe there were some dishonest players on the team. And it only takes one or two to ruin a whole team. And I'm wondering if the honesty of any of the members on your teams was ever impugned and if lie detectors were ever called for.
Well, not only was the honesty impugned, we were robbed. I mean, I know that for a fact. It sort of comes with the territory. But something that you just said made me think a little bit about what was so unique and in a way successful about our organization. And you mentioned being an investor on a blackjack team or for a blackjack team, which suggests a degree of distance from the activities of the actual team. And the way our group was structured, it's a difficult thing, right? There are people in the blackjack world who will tell you, look, you just can't trust other people. You know, there are solo players who would really never think about going joint bank with somebody or, you know, forming a team because of the obvious trust issues. And then there are people who believe it can be done and try to do it advisedly. And just believing that it was possible went a long way toward making it work for our group. But another thing that we did that was different is that there was no such thing as a passive investor. Everybody with money at risk was there in action also. And the management was very hands-on. There was a real sense of intimacy and camaraderie. We were all fighting in it together. So the incidents of theft, so far as I can tell, judging from the results, there are no particular red flags that would indicate long-standing chronic problems. But, you know, you work with enough people, you're obviously going to run into a couple of rotten eggs or bad apples or bad eggs or whatever the phrase is. And we did.
Back to the disguises a little bit. You said that you wore your hair in dreadlocks. Now, you are a white man, lives in Brooklyn. Dreadlocks would be a strange thing and relatively easy for casino management to remember. So for somebody who's trying to look inconspicuous, dreadlocks seems to be the wrong way to go. So how long did you do this, and why did you do it this way?
Well, you know, I was trying to look cool, let's be honest. And to some extent, the entire blackjack experiment and delving into that world had to do with a certain romantic itch that I had that wasn't, I didn't find any other satisfaction for in my life. So if being a card counter meant like not in some way espousing a certain aesthetic, it might have been problematic for me early on. I will say that my early trips, a few of my teammates and I had the idea that it would actually be useful to have this quite eccentric look, because I didn't look anything like anybody that the Pit had ever seen in their casino before. They would actually ask themselves, we hoped, the very question you just asked, which is what right card counter in his right mind would present himself in such memorable fashion. But it turned out that, you know, no card counter in his right mind really would, because it's very memorable. And I ended up getting heat very quickly, and I think the dreads had something to do with that. And I cut them after about a year. But in the meantime, there was a long period of wearing hats and wigs over the dreadlocks. And when I finally represented myself in Las Vegas, the dreadlocks had grown out a lot. And when the period of time that I spent doing the most money betting, where I, as opposed to just, you know, betting table minimum and being a counter at the table, was actually placing the large bets, most of that was done with the big full set of dreadlocks out and flourishing. And by that time, they looked a little bit different than they had before during my first round of heat. And I'd use some other disguise elements with them to try to cover up parts of my face. And even, you know, that said, when you're running call-ins like that, you know, you're generating something in the neighborhood of $1,000 per hour per counter. You make money fast. You get blown out fast. You're not looking to get down for, you know, a day. A few hours is a very worthwhile amount of time in a casino.
The way you came onto our radar was our former host, Richard Munchkin, heard a podcast on something called Moth Podcast. Tell us about themoth.org.
Right, the Moth. The Moth, yes, which you can find at themoth.org, is an arts organization based in New York, but that's now operating all around the country. And they host live performances where a combination of people, some of whom are artists or writers or actors, but many of whom are not experienced, you know, crafters of stories or experienced performers, but have simply had real things happen to them in their lives that are fascinating to hear. The organization brings these people together and curates shows with them, telling their stories live on stage with no notes, nothing to read from, just communicating live to an audience. And it's a very dynamic thing, and you can listen to the podcast, which is available at the website, themoth.org, and they have a radio show that's on a growing number of public radio stations, the Moth Radio Hour, and I heard recently that will be moving to a weekly format, so there's going to be more Moth coming, I think, to the country. But that's I guess, where Richard Munchkin had first heard me, and that's where I sort of first started telling blackjack stories to a larger audience.
Now, the Moth podcast that I heard was about the Gold Watch, and I've posted it on in a couple places to tell people to come listen to the show tonight. And the several features of that particular story that are in the book. So part of your story is part, your book is partly about writing the book and having trouble writing the book, which is kind of curious. But did you use the Moth as a way to get around your writer's block and then go ahead and write down what you said at the Moth? Or had you already written the book and then you're just kind of regurgitating in another format what you had already written?
Well, I learned a lot about writing from the Moth, honestly. I mean, I'd been writing in various forms for many years, trying to develop, you know, a compelling voice on the page and a way of presenting reality with some kind of integrity. And one of the things that's very hard for writers is understanding who your audience is and how the words and incidents that you have to show them that you feel are somehow urgent, how they're received and how they feel. And one thing that's fascinating for me as a writer about taking the stage at the Moth is that you know immediately when you're failing to communicate, when you're failing to bring things together, and you definitely know when you're succeeding.
Because just by looking at their faces.
By looking at their faces, by listening to their laughs, yes, you can see it and feel it when a story's really coming together. And that was important. That was just an extraordinary experience for me as a writer.
Well, speaking of writing, I hear that you got a $300,000 advance for your book, which is about $300,000 more than Bob and I got for our books. So do you have any advice for aspiring writers out there how to get such a good deal?
I think a time machine helps. I think
a time machine.
I'm sorry. I'm sad to say the industry is changing rapidly, and the size of advances has been dwindling for many consecutive years. The integral ingredient there, I would say, was my agent Daniel Greenberg, who is sort of the SEAL Team 6 of literary representation. He goes in the dark of night, busts into the editor's house, more or less, kind of roughs things up, throws the bodies into the ocean the next day. I mean, he was an extraordinary agent.
Sounds like a useful guy to have on your side.
In a lot of endeavors, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
That was a central part of it. That and the fact that it was a New York publisher, and they billed the book as a literary debut. And in that particular instance, it's a little counterintuitive, but the fact that it was a debut, I think, added to the sale price because that adds to the marketing buzz, to the initial momentum in the particular genre of a lit memoir. They were billing it as, the discovery of some new voice. So I think that the fact that I had not previously published was, in that particular instance, beneficial. Now, obviously, if you're already Stephen King and you're selling huge numbers of copies, you're in a different league and you'll command big advances all the time. But otherwise, there's a little bit of a premium, at least in that particular market, I think, for first-time authors.
Huh. Very good. It's now, so the book is available at Amazon.com and other places. Is it through your website as well, or just through the normal places you can buy books?
I just Google "Repeat Until Rich." It comes right up. Amazon and normal places like that. My website is probably a model lesson, a study in how not to market oneself. I've never taken to that. I have no particular aptitude for it. People can go to axelrad.net if they want. They can read my bio. It's been revised about 1,000 times, so it's the result of painstaking work. I'd love any feedback on the bio. Beyond that, there's not a lot on the website. But yeah, Amazon has it. All the major vendors have it. It's available on Kindle forms and various ebook formats as well.
So after the Blackjack team broke up for a variety of reasons, you began to play poker online unsuccessfully. You lost your money. You lost your self-respect. A few times you went to Gamblers Anonymous, but you didn't appear to be able to relate to the other people who were at Gamblers Anonymous. Tell us about that.
I will say that Gamblers Anonymous, well, first of all, if there are people listening in Las Vegas tonight who have been, reading some of Bob's books perhaps, but have found themselves struggling and in a position where they don't have emotional and intellectual authority over their gambling behavior, like they're really not sure about their edge or whether they have one or what they're doing, they should get themselves to a Gamblers Anonymous meeting within 12 hours if they can. It's an essential first step for people who are really in trouble. That said, it is also a very weird place to be when you're in the black. The story of the net winner fallen on hard times, but still with having supported himself gambling for years and with a substantial net win and overall a positive relationship and positive impression of the experiences that he's had, that is a story that doesn't sit especially well with the recovering gambling addiction community for reasons that I now understand perfectly well. But it was a really tough encounter for them as well as for me. But I think the organization is very important for a lot of people.
Well, at any of these meetings, did anyone ever ask you, oh, so I can have an edge? Then, if I learn how to play properly, I don't need to give up gambling after all. Did anyone ever ask you that?
Well, what I got more from them was the opposite of that, was people swearing up and down that there was no such thing as gambling with an edge. There was a person there who claimed to have lost 7 figures playing online poker badly. And he, at one point, and the things get very emotional and people speak kind of from the gut, but he gave an impassioned speech to the effect of, all this stuff they show on TV is a lie, the World Series of Poker is a lie, the competition is a lie, there's no such thing as winning at poker, it's all just luck. And it's one of those situations when you're sitting there and you also have your emotional needs and are also in a crisis, but you don't know what to say to the person because it's very difficult to stand up and say, well, I'm sorry, I know this sucks and the position that we're all in sucks. But the reality is I know people who play poker consistently excel and have had winning results for consecutive years. There's no question that the game is skill-based. It's just people in the mentality that you and I have entered into with this game are not going to be the ones to beat it. That's not a conversation that's going to really do anybody any good.
They would say you're in denial.
They would, exactly. And I think to some extent my entire presentation was like just unthinkable to them, like very difficult to digest, like it, as if the whole thing had been a hallucination, which, to be honest, at some points it felt like when I was, you know, particularly down in the bottom of a particular despairing cycle that I got myself into.
One thing you and I have in common is that we both lose money at online poker, and I'm embarrassed to admit it as a gambling writer, but I think making money in online poker is tough. And can you tell us a little bit about your misadventures with that?
Oh, it's generous of you to admit that. One of the things I have found in the Advantage gambling community is half the people I talk to who have been card counters or Advantage players look at me like it's just not possible. Like, basically, you either are an Advantage player, but you're some sort of monster. But nobody is both. And the other half of the Advantage player community has said the exact opposite. And they've actually said, you know what, Josh, we really relate to this. We've experienced it in our own lives, or we know people who have experienced it in their own careers. The reality is, from their perspective, gambling behavior falls along a spectrum or a scale, sort of like the Kinsey scale of sexual orientation, where, you know, not everybody is purely straight or purely gay. A lot of people are in the middle. So I have now spieled and forgotten the question that you just asked me. Oh, it was about online poker, but what was it? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I asked to tell a little bit about why you lost in online poker.
Right. Well, there were multiple reasons, and, you know, we could do a whole psychohistory, and I'd love to do that, but the program probably can't go on for 7 or 8 days.
Well, we do have 3 minutes total.
Okay, well, I'll try to do it in 1 minute. Fundamentally, there were a lot of things that were very dark and wrong in my life and psyche at that time. At a very basic level, I didn't particularly care about winning money at poker. I didn't want to much going in. It didn't strike me that winning money from casinos, I think, is one of the nobler things one can do with gambling. I think it's beautiful. I think if casinos are staffed by people who are, you know, when I'm feeling ungenerous, I have trouble characterizing them as human beings, but they're certainly very, very dark. And they know that they're involved in a very, very dark and loathsome activity and that they do nothing good for the world. They know that. And I know it. Other online poker players, I just don't feel that way about. I don't particularly, not that I also didn't have the skill, right? So I created a pattern of playing that I shouldn't have gotten into. But from the outset, I didn't care that much. It didn't seem important to me to take money from some guy on the internet. It didn't seem noble. It didn't seem necessary. It didn't seem virtuous. I just didn't care. And that's not at all the right way to play poker. you should really actually want to win a lot. But that was sort of the grounding in the outset. Some psychological darkness and a complete lack of really caring about generating an edge in the game.
Okay.
In the book, at one point in Louisiana, there were uniformed police officers pointing their guns at you and yelling instructions at you. Personally, I hate it when that happens. It sounds like the kind of day you wish you were wearing brown pants. Now, tell us about this.
Well, just because of my complexion, I often do wear brown pants.
So oh, good.
That maybe wasn't so much of an issue specifically. But, you know, what happened that night in Louisiana is something that I think happens a lot in Louisiana. You know, there was a whole Dateline NBC episode, I think, about that particular stretch of I-10, and specifically about cops pulling people over and then confiscating their money under various pretexts. So there was some precedent for it. In that particular case, what was weird about it was that we were pulled over for speeding, which we were guilty of, on the bridge over the Atchafalaya Swamp. I don't know how to say that word, but, you know, long word, starts with Atcha. We were pulled over for speeding, and the driver got out of the car, and he was carrying a good bit of cash, which they found when they patted them down. And that occasioned a long, hour-long detention at the side of the interstate, during which the Louisiana State Troopers were trying to be really professional. They understood something weird was happening. We had well over 100 grand, I think, close to 150 between us. The trip was winning. You know, we were getting more money all the time, which can be a problem occasionally. And they asked a lot of questions. I had all the play documentation. I had my tax returns. I gave them all this. And they kept us there for a while, said they were making some phone calls to casinos. They were verifying our story. Then they let us go. Now, they knew we were driving towards Baton Rouge. And actually, I think you had Casey, this card counter with the documentary coming out
yes.
on your show not long ago. I listened to that, and he mentioned something also happening in Baton Rouge that involved a casino crossing the line. It may have been the same casino. I'm not sure. He mentioned, I think, the Belle of Baton Rouge. This was the Casino Argosy, but I think it's changed its name. I don't know if that's the same place or not, but there were only two there at that time anyway. But the point is, we drove into Baton Rouge. We you know, the hour was over. We had been released. So we were like, well, we're here to count cards. Let's go and count some. And we got to the casino, which at that time was the Argosy. And one of our guys went in to scout conditions in the casino. It was a woman, actually. And as she got to the door, the side entrance to the ramp to the riverboat that, where we had parked, suddenly there was a cop with a gun pointing it right at her back. And this was one of the state troopers who had previously patted down all of us and searched for all of our belongings. Okay, so this is an officer who had good reason to know that none of us was armed and none of us was in any way particularly threatening. And with his gun trained at her back, this 22-year-old woman, he ordered her, you know, over to the car to put her hands on the hood, and then he brought us all out of the car, and it was a big production. And they kept us there for, again, a considerable amount of time. And finally, one of the officers, again, one of the state troopers, came to ask me some more questions about card counting. I was very annoyed with him. Finally, they just got on the phone, got off the phone again, and released us all. But they said, before you go, we need you to do something, so just stand right over here. And they put us up against a brick wall near that casino. And we looked over, and we saw that somebody was coming with a camera to photograph us. And the police said, you know, you're just stay here for a minute, we'll do this, and then you're free to go. And when I realized that the person who had the camera was wearing a uniform from that casino, when I realized that that was what was happening, I looked at one of the two officers, the original state troopers who had pulled us over, and one of them was kind of dumb, and one of them was kind of smart. And I looked at the smart one, and I said, I'm sorry, officer, are you requiring us, after not charging us with a crime after all of this detention, are you requiring us to pose for a photograph that this private company wants to take as a condition of our release? And the officer looked at me, understood the underlying meaning of that question, and just walked away like he wasn't going to answer it. And then his dumb partner walked up right after him and said, yep. And at that point, what are you going to do? I mean, there's only so much fight you have in you. And the reality
you contact Bob Nersessian, who's a frequent guest on our show, and he's done well at suing police departments and casinos and stuff for stuff like this.
Yes, of course. It's a good idea. The problem is when you're stuck in the middle of Louisiana with the cash, and all these cops know that you're in the middle of Louisiana with the cash, and they know your vehicle and your plates and the fact that you're not armed, you don't feel physically safe.
Yeah,
right?
For sure.
They're cops.
All right.
Yeah, so we were more concerned with getting out of Louisiana at that point.
All right, sounds good. Josh, I want to thank you, and we're going to let you go. Thank you very much. I wish you continued success on Repeat and Tell Rich, and continued success on finding the meaning of life.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
All righty. Michael, what did we learn?
That was a lot of dark stuff about the world of advantage play, and there certainly is a lot of that in the world. And what did we learn? I learned how to come off as if I had been drinking a lot by rinsing my mouth with an alcoholic drink in the bathroom, but not drinking it. I had never heard that tip before. And I liked his advice about getting about the time machine, about getting a good advance for my next book. And,
that one is really useful.
And
good. Is it going to be Gambling 103? Is that your next book?
Or 101.
All right. Good. Now, a few months ago, we had a guest named Ed Miller. Ed Miller wrote some books for low-limit poker players, and he sent an email just this last week. He's now getting into table games, and he says, what are the good media outlets to monitor to find out about new table games or new side bets or new promotions, etc.? This is a question that I bet a lot of your listeners would like to know. So, Michael, why don't you handle this?
Well, if I may put modesty aside for the moment, that's what my site's all about. I like to be the first site out there to cover any new game or side bet. And my Wizard of Odds site, I would think I would like to be known as the place to go to find what's new in the world of new games. And I think I am often the first site to break how to play obscure new casino games.
All right. So what's new and different on your sites?
Okay. Well, on my Wizard of Vegas site, I just wrote an article about my trip to Laughlin. And on my Wizard of Odds...
All the way to Laughlin?
Yeah, I didn't go all the way to somewhere as far as Argentina this time.
Uh-huh.
So on my Wizard of Odds site, I wrote my first Ask the Wizard column in 3 months. It's been tough getting good questions, and I wrote an article about, or a page about the history of the game of Paigao Tiles. I wrote something about Build-A-Wheel Video Poker. But what I'm most proud of is I wrote a page called Deconstructing Jackpot Party. And what's always held me back from talking about slot machines before is that they don't say, here are exactly what the rules are. Here is the exact real stripping of the game. The player is basically making a leap of faith when he plays a slot machine that he's going to get a respectable rate of return. So what I did was I took my cell phone camera to the Wynn, and I played a jackpot party game, and I recorded about 20 minutes of play, and I played it as fast as possible. And then I studied these videos very carefully, where I froze the video on every single hand, or actually I had my brother-in-law do this, and record every single sequence of symbols on all five reels. And what I was able to do, piecing together these combinations like a puzzle, I was able to determine what the real stripping was, the entire loop of the real strips on all five reels. And then it was just a matter of doing the math on these real strips and on the bonus game, which they nicely tell you all the possible prizes in the bonus. So took a while, but I wrote down all my math and explained, here is exactly what the return of this particular game was. And for this penny game at the Wynn, I found the return to be about 86%. And I don't mean to embarrass the Wynn over that. I think any high-end Vegas casino is going to pay around that for a penny slot. So it just goes to show you what a lousy bet slot machines are.
Good. All right. Let me talk about some of our other commercials. Sponsors. South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else. The three double point days this month are Valentine's Day, next Tuesday, President's Day, and February 29th, which is called Leap Year Day. Through tomorrow, if you earn 3,000 points this week, Monday through Friday, you will qualify for a South Point logo jacket. You must claim the jacket by Monday or forfeit your chance at it. They have free online poker at southpointpoker.com. Every month, $100,000 in cash and prizes is given away, including a seat at next year's World Series of Poker main event. This coming Wednesday's free video poker class is Deuces Bonus Poker. Deuces Bonus is a hybrid game that combines Deuces Wild with Bonus Poker. You receive higher pay in this game for five of a kinds and less money for straights. At the Palms, the Palms introduced a seniors program in January called Sterling Advantage for players 50 years of age and older. Every month, the prize package will be a little bit different. This month, there's a Thursday slot tournament, and there's $7,500 in prizes, and there'll also be $2,500 each week given away in drawing. Play, earn, and win through the middle of the month is Valentine's Day theme, where the most interesting gift, as far as I'm concerned, is a Kindle Touch for 25,000 video poker points, keeping the points. For the same amount of money, you also can get a $100 gift certificate at Edible Arrangements if you like chocolate-covered strawberries. They're having drawings Tuesday and Friday. So the drawing tomorrow night, Friday at 7 p.m., any play you do until 6:45 tomorrow night counts for tickets for that. And then starting at 6:46, you're earning tickets for the following Tuesday and Friday. There are 8 winners each of the 2 nights. And of those, 5 go to the end of the month drawing where they get a puzzle piece, where the puzzle piece on average are worth $450. But most people, 25 out of 30, will end up with exactly 100, and 5 people will get bigger prizes. It's a kind of a drawing where the first few people get a large amount of money and no puzzle piece for the end of the month, and the lower prizes are like $250 and a puzzle piece. So, and you're there for 2, Tuesday and Friday. So when you decide which week to play for it, you're playing for 2 drawings. So taking that into consideration is part of Gambling with an Edge. The VideoPoker.com promotion for this month, which hasn't started yet, it'll start later, is for 25 play super times pay. 25 play is, well, like five play, 10 play, or 50 play, except it's 25. Super times pay is every 15 hands you get a multiplier. You play 6 coins per line instead of 5, and the multiplier makes that all come out to be fine. In these, their monthly contest, it is usually 200 hands that you play. You can play as many times as you want. The game to play in this contest is triple double bonus, because you're going to need to be dealt either royal or dealt aces and a kicker in order to be in the top, or in the running for the top prizes. So those are the games where they have the most chances to get one of these top prizes. And if you're really good, you get it with a 10 times multiplier. That's for the good players. All right, Michael, tell us who Dolly Wong is and why should we care?
Dolly Wong is going to be our next guest next week. She is the woman behind one of my favorite websites, cocktaildoll.com. She also is a cocktail waitress here in Las Vegas, and her website tells all about interesting and amusing stories that happened to her on the job. It tells all about how to get a job as a cocktail waitress and make as much money as possible at it. And Dolly is very effervescent and funny and doesn't hold much back, so I'm really looking forward to having her.
Is she related to Stanford Wong?
No, and I'm not, no, you, no, she's not.
Stanford Wong is Caucasian, and Dolly Wong is not.
Yes, Dolly Wong looks like a Dolly Wong, and I didn't know if I was allowed to say that Stanford Wong is a Caucasian. I didn't know if he is still keeping that a secret.
Oh, well, it's out.
Now everyone knows.
All right. Now, we mentioned themoth.org when we were talking to Josh. And part of it is people who want to tell these stories submit a 3-minute capsule of what they want to talk about. Now, I was looking through to see one of them if it was interest, and one of them talked about somebody winning money from a Russian casino, and the Russian casino didn't have enough money to pay them off. And it was by somebody named R.M., and, of course, after listening to Richard Munchkin for 6 months on the show, then I knew exactly who it was. So I clicked on it that, yes, I think this ought to be a good thing to have on the show. So I recommend you go to themoth.org, listen to Richard's story, and click yes. You'd like to hear that on the air. Otherwise, we'll be forced to bring it back as a guest, which wouldn't be all bad. I like Richard. I like his stories.
Me too. He always tells a great story. In our last minute, I want to say happy birthday to my wife, Mrs. Wizard. And speaking
Mrs. of Mrs. Wizard, that's what she goes by?
No. I just wanted to respect her privacy. And but speaking of not respecting,
I'm going to blow her privacy. Her name is Mrs. Shackelford.
But speaking of not respecting privacy, Shirley asked me to.
Shirley?
Yes. Your Shirley asked me to say that it's going to be your birthday this Wednesday, and that she will be bringing cake to your video poker class, which you just mentioned. So how is Shirley?
compared to whom? No, that's an old Henny Youngman joke. Shirley is great. There are people who have wanted to meet Shirley who haven't had a chance, and she'll be at the class next week, and we'll have plenty of cake. And everybody for present, buy 3 copies of my software.
See you next week, everybody.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Be known as the expert in your industry. Are you willing to take your business to the next level? Customers buy or do business with people they know, like, and trust. What better way for you to achieve all 3 of these goals than with your very own radio program? With your own 4-hour show, you can interact, inform, educate potential customers in a form like no other medium. KLAV 1230 AM, Las Vegas' second oldest radio station, with a full signal reaching the entire Las Vegas market and the world as we stream on the internet. Contact us today at 796-1230 and discuss how you can brand and market your business in a new media environment to stand out from the crowd. Call 796-1230 and ask for Bruce or Darylin, and we will tell you how easy and affordable it is for you to have your very own radio program. Call 796-1230.
My name is W. Ralph Mangum. This is Talkback Las Vegas on KLAV 1230 on your AM dial. Talkback Las Vegas, where everybody is somebody, and somebody has something to say. I am the heart, soul, and spirit of Talkback Las Vegas. What do you love about Las Vegas? What do you hate about Las Vegas? Who do you love in Las Vegas? We'll be on every second Thursday night at 9 p.m. here on KLAV 1230 on your AM dial. Get ready and talk back on whatever you want to talk about.
Hi, this is Leslie Lovell of Town Center Design. Listen to my show, Home Sweet Home, every Tuesday at noon on KLAV 1230 AM. We'll be talking about interior design, where and how to shop, and everything related to making your home a beautiful environment. So join me, Leslie Lovell, and my great guests for Home Sweet Home, every Tuesday at noon on KLAV. Home Sweet Home.
Hi, join the Real Liberty Hour with Brent Jones and me, Jesse Law, on Tuesdays from 6 to 7 p.m., where we'll discuss overregulation and our vanishing freedoms and give you the tools to restore liberty right here at home. Be enlightened with guests, controversy, empowerment. And hey, if you want to chime in, you can give us a call on air. Catch the Real Liberty Hour each and every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. right in your drive time and connect with us online at www.nforl.com. That's N-F-O-R-L.com.
This Wednesday morning, join us for Creative Wedding Style, hosted by me, Chance DeGlow, on Creative Wedding Style. We'll offer assorted segments covering wedding style and etiquette designed to give tips on getting your personal style infused into your wedding. From attire to reception and everything in between, Creative Wedding Style is the ultimate guide for throwing a creative and unique wedding. Check us out at creativeformalwear.com. So walk down the aisle with us every Wednesday morning at 11. Don't chance it. Trust Creative Wedding Style.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jaron Jensen, board-certified pediatric dentist and owner of Smile Reef, the premier children's dental practice. None of us love going to the dentist, especially our children, but proper dental care is critical to your child's health. Join me every other Thursday at 1 p.m. for Smile Reef Radio. We have fun conversations on oral hygiene and answer questions about sedation dentistry and caring for your children's teeth. I hope you'll join me every other Thursday at 1 p.m. for Smile Reef Radio.
Hi there, this is Sammy Hagar here for RAD, the entertainment industry's voice for road safety. Now, style's a personal thing, and your lifestyle is your business. But if you take it on the road, it becomes everybody else's business. Please, plan ahead, designate before you celebrate, because friends do not let friends drive drunk.
public service message.
Love us on radio, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. We are KLAV 1230 AM.
You're listening to KLAV Las Vegas.